Samuel, bonus material. This is our extra offshoots and extra material that we haven't found room for on our main show, and it's for the delight of our listeners, who we love very dearly, and we want to keep producing stuff for them. But these first few excerpts that we're producing are free, and eventually they're going to be available for our Patreon subscribers. So we've been talking about this for a little while, haven't we? Bonus material, what does that actually mean?
Who knows? It's kind of uncharted territory for us. I see it like a road movie where we've just kind of, you know, loaded everything we've got into a truck and we're off to see where we end up. And these are the kind of the pit stops along the way.
Can we drink and swear more along the way? Is that allowed on this section?
Who knows? We'll probably end up swearing more, particularly in today's episode, I think. We can drink more if you want. You know, I can always bring a whiskey up to my office.
It's a bit early for me, yeah. 2 o'clock in the office is just not going to fly at this point.
It's cocktail hour somewhere, I'm sure. That's what people say, isn't it? So, so these are a chance for us to kind of almost kind of do capsule episodes about things that are coming up, about things that are kind of in the air in terms of film culture, opportunities that we get in terms of people that we might get to speak to, and a way of kind of addressing some of the listener inquiries that coincide with releases. So there'll be a mixture of reviews, like today's episode, which is a review and discussion, you know, not a review in the traditional sense, but the cinematologists do reviews kind of thing. And then I'm sure there'll be sort of interviews, either longer form or shorter form, with filmmakers that we come across or academics that we meet at conferences. And then who knows what else? I'm sure that there'll just be times that we want to talk about something that doesn't quite fit in an episode we've got coming up, and we want to kind of get into it in a different way. So these will be predominantly shorter episodes for the time being. And as you mentioned, there'll be they're free for a while so that we can sort of test the water and see what people's responses to them, see if people like this this kind of form for extra stuff, and then we'll take it from there, and it'll become part of the offering for our future Patreon subscribers that hopefully are out there.
Yeah, so if you want to catch us by the usual channels, you know, we're on social media, we're on email, you know the drill, at cinematologists, cinematologists@gmail.com, or on the evil of Facebook, I'm afraid. You know, we have to utilize all of these things. Neil, this was your suggestion to put this particular subject for the first bonus episode. So what are we talking about?
Well, we are talking about social realism and two titans of British cinema to coincide with the release by the BFI of Blu-ray editions of Mike Leigh's Life is Sweet and three films by Ken Loach from his kind of early 90s period. And Loach particularly has been someone that has kind of been sort of circling around the podcast in terms of someone whose work we wanted to get into. So we thought it'd be a good opportunity with the release of these films to kind of revisit them, look at them, see what they still have to offer, and just kind of get into that stuff about social realism that we've wanted to touch on since we started, really.
Yeah. So I mean, social realism is a form, let's say. I mean, I don't know if it's a genre. Maybe we can decide that in a minute. But it's certainly integral to the British tradition of filmmaking. You know, if there is such a thing as a British film culture, it's probably predominantly made up of the dichotomy between social realism and the kind of period costume drama going back historically. You know, when I was first at university studying film, it tended to be those two types of films that were always aligned with a kind of idea of film representing British national identity and British culture. I mean, there's other stuff. There's, you know, the sort of more recently, perhaps the gangster movie is very, you know, is very predominant in terms of understanding British culture and life, and comedy as well, I think, in various forms is really important. And perhaps even going back, you know, the sort of relationship between British film and British theatre. But I mean, again, you know, to the early parts of social realism, there is that crossover. If you think of, you know, Don't Look Back in Anger and that kind of thing. But yeah, interestingly, you know, we might have a discussion about whether, I mean, Ken Loach definitely has been aligned with social realism, and aligned with more broadly realism in terms of relationships to other filmmakers in Europe, particularly, you know, the Italian neorealists. He's very much said that they're an influence on him. And, you know, the filmmakers like Costa Gravis as well, he's mentioned specifically. But then Mike Lee, I think, is slightly different. And maybe we can talk about that, because we were discussing earlier on, before we started recording, how his films seem now to be a little bit more theatrical. I mean, maybe we'll come to that. But I don't know, how does social realism have a specific kind of position for you, or definition for you?
Yeah, I think, well, position, I think, more than definition. I think you're right. It does have this this particular place in British cinema history and culture, which, you're absolutely right, kind of stems from the Angry Young Man kind of kitchen sink period, which obviously kind of came out of theatre and that kind of, you know, sort of post-war period. But was it, it's interesting what you sort of say about Mike Lee then, because I think that realism is such a, well, we know it's problematic, but it's also a very fluid term, you know. So realism in the kind of the British New Wave is, feels real in comparison to what else is out there, you know, that very kind of, well, like say the staid period dramas, or a very kind of heightened and theatrical kind of, you know, mainstream British, plus obviously those kind of very arch comedies. So it feels very different to that. So realism is what it's called. But then as time moves on, you look at the work of Loach in the 80s, and he kind of does really kind of probably start a more kind of tangible realism with something like Kathy Come Home, you know, which is, you know, obviously starting to use kind of non-professional or kind of emerging actors, you know, people without that kind of stage experience or training to access those kind of stories, and shooting it, you know, in that kind of lo-fi documentary style, in comparison to what's gone before. But then, you know, things in the 80s look more realistic in that sense of realism compared to the kitchen sink dramas of the and so on and so forth. When, by the time you get to something like Nil by Mouth, which is brutally realist, it makes the work of even the early 90s stuff of Ken Loach feel quite tame and not very real in comparison. But I think it's a shifting term, isn't it? So
yeah, well, I think the big difficulty is something that you've kind of not said specifically, but came out in the terminology that you were just using then, in terms of the kind of conflagration between realism and realistic.
Yeah.
And I think that happens all the time. And I think one of the problems, or one of the criticisms of people like Loach, is that their blurring of the boundaries between documentary and drama is one thing that sort of causes this problem, in terms of when you say realism, you can't just sort of equate that to something being realistic, because, you know, you could say that an American drama is realistic if it's set in the present day and, you know, it's not a sci-fi or whatever. Do you know what I mean? It has realistic kind of anchoring points to it, whereas realism, I think, is has to be understood as very much a sort of formal construction as much as anything else, you know, because people will talk about, you know, oh, it's a realist film, it is an example of realism, say, if it's in black and white, which, you know, again, is suddenly you're getting into really problematic areas about how do we see what's perspective realistically. And then, you know, and again, I think what has to be taken into account in terms of the realism of someone like Ken Loach and Mike Lee is this focus on the working class and the idea of the working class struggle, or the struggle of ordinary people, let's say, because, again, you can sort of, you know, there's so many different possibilities of definition, particularly as we move through the 20th century in terms of where the class distinctions are. So, yeah, it's a really sort of difficult and problematic term. And I think, when we're teaching it, or when I've taught social realism, it is very much trying to get across that realism does have this cinematic constructive elements to it that make it that directors are striving for in order to portray a particular kind of representation of a certain, you know, of a certain class of people, let's say. I mean, it's interesting when you sort of relate that to questions of authenticity, and this kind of thing, and even truth, because again, that's where I think some filmmakers come unstuck in terms of saying this is how it is, and this is what happened. And again, you know, there are, like I say, with Loach, there are blurring of the boundaries between documentary and drama and fact and fiction. Again, if you want to make those distinctions, and some of his films are obviously based on true events. You know, Lady Bird is an example of that. But looking back on it now, as we've just watched it, the you know, recently with these re-releases, you really do see the sort of sense of construction going on, or I did anyway, in certain regards, particularly.
Yeah, I think that, you know, we've talked a lot about realism there. We haven't really talked about the word social, and I think that is a key word for both of them, but in different ways, you know, different kind of connotations of the word. So Loach, yeah, rewatching stuff has a preoccupation with society and stratas of society and how that plays out, you know, in as a system. But Lee, the more I think about it, the more I, you know, think about his films, seems more interested in the social in terms of the kind of the everyday relationships between people, not necessarily across classes, but within the same class, you know. And they're, you know, absolutely kind of fascinated with the details of a social life. And, and I think that, you know, there is often a kind of real focus on the realism without as much kind of thought on the social. And I absolutely agree with in terms of, which I think is why, you know, some of Loach's work might feel quite dated, because it's so closely tied to society at the time of the experience. And some of that is kind of ever renewing and timeless, and some of it isn't, you know. Some of it is kind of specific to a time, which makes it feel very, you know, very, very specific. But, you know, you sort of saying about the filmmakers falling into that trap, we were kind of talking about this, you know, sort of conversing as we were watching the films, and it was like, well, what's his intention there? And I don't really know. You know, he talks very politically, and Daniel Blake, which we will talk about as well, is something that clearly gave an outlet for his political voice as a person. But I'm still not sure what kind of filmmaker he is, really. You know, it's someone who's deeply interested in people and the system. But is he just seeing, you know, is there a statement, or is that something that's placed on by us? Mm. Or is it just the way he sees society and stories that he feels are important to be told, just to tell the story? And that's still, you know, that's still something I'm not quite sure about. And I'm interested to think about more, I guess.
Mm. So what did you make then? I mean, we'll start with Mike Lee. That was the first one I watched this week. And obviously these Blu-rays have been re-released. I mean, it's an interesting thing. Just thinking about it, the sort of re-release of in this day and age when everything is streamed and all of that kind of thing. So we have the re-release of these, you know, what are, I mean, again, I'm not going to get into the discussion of whether they're canonical films or not, but key films of the mid-period of these directors. And what you would get out of buying these Blu-rays, when you think about the way that the films, but both of these directors' films are shot on film, but in a very, it's a very sort of grainy hue to the stock, as it were, and it produces a particular effect, which makes the films, I think it makes all the films look older than they actually are. So, I wonder, I haven't seen the Blu-ray, I just watched the films on the internet, but you having seen the Blu-rays, do you see a sort of an actual reason for these products beyond the films themselves?
I have been thinking about that, and it's kind of conflicted response, really. So the transfer is beautiful, and the film looks beautiful on the new Blu-ray. And you know, the kind of the skill and the craft and the composition of the film is more clearly visible than it might be through another medium, you know, where it's kind of competing for bandwidth, whatever. So it does look beautiful, but then I'm sitting there thinking, like, you know, like you say, people don't buy as many films as they used to. Who's going to buy this particular film and why, you know? But on the other hand, you know, they've got additional material, including a really lovely piece by Ashley Clark, about kind of Timothy Spall and his performance, you know, and Spall as an actor, and, you know, that fine line which Lee treads between sympathy and ridicule for his characters. You know, it's a really beautiful piece, and I'm thinking, well, you know, me being me, I'm glad I've got, you know, the press pack with it because I read it, and otherwise that thing would just be put up on the internet separate and no one would ever necessarily watch it because no one's figured out how to have additional material on a streaming, you know, like that kind of interactive package, really. But then I thought, well, I'm obviously in the minority, and then I thought, well, if I hadn't have been sent the pack to talk about it, Life is Sweet is not necessarily, even though I like collecting the Blu-ray, so what's the audience? How big is that audience of Mike Lee devotees who are going to, you know, so it's interesting. And then I thought, well, is it more that, you know, so the release by the BFI, and Mike Lee is a filmmaker who has a long tradition of work supported by, probably not to the degree that most people would say he deserves, but definitely a history of supported by, he's making a new film now. How much is it keeping the conversation about Mike Lee going, you know, so that when the film comes around next time, there's a buzz and people want to see it and people are aware that he's still a relevant filmmaker. We're still talking about Mike Lee, who's, towards the end of his career in comparative terms. And how much is it that they've got the film, you know, in terms of the rights, and people still want to talk about it, but it's kind of like it's all part of, you know, which is probably the cynical part of me thinking, well, it's all part of the Mike Lee brand and keeping that going so that he's a viable entity commercially when his new film comes out. I don't know.
Yeah. No, it's really, I mean, just now thinking about it, it's really kind of ironic when, like, watching it again, Life is Sweet, and, you know, it is such a post-Thatcherite dream kind of criticism in a way. And the Aubrey character is sort of like this, you know, he reminded me a little bit of sort of Loads of Money, you know, the character, the Harry Enfield character. You know, slightly different, but like, and all of the characters in there are sort of fighting for this position in the economic system, and they're clearly being told that you have to make it on your own. You're an individual. There's no, society is not going to look after you. And they're all kind of hustling. And the Jim Broadbent character is clearly, you know, has these delusions about what this, you know, this hot dog stand caravan is gonna produce for him. And the sort of brilliance of the Aubrey character. I mean, you'll have to send me that piece because I haven't read it. But this sort of positioning of the lower middle classes attempting to be entrepreneurs and the kind of desperation of that is absolutely brilliant. And I see it almost more of a comedy than social realism for me. And the characters, the difference between the characters in Lee and Loach is that I think that they are, in Lee, they are exaggerations of British typologies that do exist, but they're playing on those sort of stereotypes and typologies for kind of comedy value rather than getting to the absolute, you know, devastation that's even when there's comedy moments in Loach, there's still that underlying absolute devastation and class depression that is going on. So Loach's characters seem more in tune more directly affected by the social conditions that they happen to be in. Whereas I think that just watching Life is Sweet, the kind of Thatcherite elements of it is woven much more subtly as a milieu in which these characters are operating, because the focus is this sort of the individual dramas a little more, I would say. I mean, again, more or less, how do you measure that? But yeah, you know, you get what I mean.
Yeah, no, I think it's a subtler film, very theatrical. You know, it's like I was watching and thinking, like, this, the dialogue and the performances are, you know, it's beautifully scripted, and the performances, like, you know, watching, you could just watch Broadbent and Stedman all day. I mean, just, they're just absolutely wonderful. In terms of that kind of repartee and banter and the relationship, and it's just effortless, you know. And the two daughters, I think, are incredibly prescient in terms of, you know, looking at young people that we teach now, you know, 25 years later, that kind of the pressure to be something and how young people deal with that, without having any kind of, you know, like any real concept of what it is to be a person or what, you know, what type of person to be. And, you know, I mean, Jane Horrocks' character is just kind of tragic kind of character who's just but and again, a great performance. But it is kind of it does seem to be clear that Lee is interested in these people in this situation, like you say, in this particular time.
And the suffocation of kind of lower middle class suburbia is much less sort of overtly didactic, you know, in terms of the way it's presented as an environment than it would be in Loach. You know what I mean? He's going for much more, you know, specifically working class and, you know, what even we'd call the precariat now. You know, that is a milieu that is affecting directly, you know, it's very much more kind of overtly Marxist in terms of the, you know, the dialectic of history, you know, the fact that we are defined by our position in relation to the, you know, to labor relations and that kind of thing. But and in a sense, it's funny because that suburban lifestyle I do recognize, you know, as coming from, and the sort of the boredom of being in these, you know, little houses and the way that they're decorated, and you know, it does play with that. But again, I do think that it does look like sort of, you know, early 90s comedy in a sense. And it's really funny how we have this, now we have this discussion all the time about the relationship between TV and film and are they coming together. You know what I mean? It does look like, it does look a lot like telly. It looks like soap or you know, a Carolina Hearn sitcom or something like that, you know?
Yeah, I think that might be a bit harsh in terms of, you know, having seen it on the, you know, but I completely understand what you're saying. Yeah, and it has a very, very specific setting that it kind of wants to kind of spend time within. One of the things I really loved about it was the first kind of, you know, 20 minutes before we see Aubrey, you know, when we're just in the house with Jim Broadbent and Alison Steadman's character, it's you're unsure whether you know, it kind of plays with people's understandings of what social realism and what, you know, what those kind of stories are about. Because I was like, because I hadn't seen it in a long time, and I thought, does he have a job? It seems like a character who doesn't have a job. Seems like one of those kind of waster characters, yeah. You know, who's just kind of bumming around, you know, unable to get work, you know, or unwilling to get work. And then you sort of, then you see the boredom of his job, and, you know, and then it just, I just thought it was in so many ways like that. The film was so subtly constructed in terms of making you think that you've seen this character, type of character before, and then subtly, you know, kind of pulling the rug out from under your feet. And doing small things with it, which obviously is something that Lee is, you know, Lee is a meticulous writer from devised work. So it's, this idea of his improvisation is kind of so misleading, you know, because it's so clearly written, and that patter between characters can't be improvised. You know, it's almost screwball in terms of its timing and how everything bounces off each other. It's really, really superbly done. And what I kind of made me think of was, you know, that it is funny now. And was it as funny then, or was it, you know, people called it realism because they'd never seen necessarily characters like that or represented in that way in a film, you know, or not since Lee did kind of Abigail's Party, kind of, which obviously more overtly comedic. You know, there's much more sadness here that's on the surface. I would say, obviously, I haven't seen Abigail's Party in a long time, but, you know, almost makes me think, like, people say something is, oh, it's realism, just because it's unfamiliar. But now we look back, having seen more and more, particularly in the kind of 90s and early 2000s, more of those kind of stories, that we can appreciate the more the subtle comedy and the subtle characterizations more because it's less familiar.
Yeah, so in terms of sort of moving on to Loach, it sort of brought home to me the sort of real problems in leftist politics watching these films again. You know, I mean, you sort of mentioned it earlier on. The way in which the marrying up of the film and how the film is, you know, written, shot, produced as a film, and the relationship to the politics is really fascinating, because it's really difficult to, as you said, gauge what his intention is. And actually, watching all three of them, I was kind of like, I'm not enjoying watching these films, right? So I might be getting riled up, you know, politically, but I also didn't think that they offered any solutions that shows that the leftist politics has grasped anything in the in the meantime. And I think that is absolutely kind of at the heart of the reaction I had when I watched I, Daniel Blake, which you know makes you absolutely livid. But then when you sort of look at it, I mean, one of the main problems that I have looking back at these films is the way in which characters are very, you know, one-dimensional in certain regards. And I mean, and like, it's really funny because I do not know a lot of people who work in social care, and I know a lot of people who are police officers and former police officers, and it really sort of struck me how they are singular instruments of the state with no, you know, they're almost ciphers for that kind of overarching Foucauldian notion of power, and not real people at all. Whereas the working class people that Loach wants to lionize are oftentimes they are absolutely sanctified, or beatified is the right word. Do you know what I mean? And there's a real sort of problematic way in which those two positions are sort of played off against each other. And I really don't know how to deal with that. It's very difficult to sort of wrap your head around how to feel about that when, you know, I consider myself sort of left of centre politically. I mean, and now if you attach yourself with the centre, that's seen as an evil thing. And it just shows how polarised things, you know, still are, and perhaps even more are now than they were back then, which seems incredible when you think of the sort of relationship between Loach and Thatcher.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think you're bang on in terms of the individual versus the state. You know, it does seem very kind of a binary, you know, really hard binary that is difficult to really comprehend a lot of the time. I kind of disagree in terms of the representations of class, because I think that rewatching them, what I found most interesting and what I found most rewarding was, you know, which kind of want to see explored more, because I think this is where the films are stronger, you know, is the which is again kind of, you know, alluding back to the kind of the Marxist thing, which is the operation of kind of hierarchies within class, you know. So on the building site, in terms of, you know, the foreman and the, you know, the workers, the race, particularly in Riff Raff, you know, there's that wonderful scene where they, you know, they send the guy to get the, you know, and
the money,
and then in Lady Bird, people living on the estate and how they view themselves in relation to other people, you know. I think that stuff's great, and feels more like actually this has a kind of a realism, you know, to it that kind of really drives the emotional core of the story, because, you know, but and then I think, well, maybe does he think that he has to draw the state as such an evil entity in order to, you know, make that those moments where what he sees as the working class, or as, you know, as his protagonist, kind of more emotionally powerful. I don't really know. And, you know, Lady Bird, man, that is brutal. I mean, it's just it's kind of unrelenting and kind of unfulfilling, really, because and I watched it back to back with I, Daniel Blake, because I hadn't seen that, and I saw it together, and I thought, this is essentially the same film remade, you know. But what was, and I'll, you know, so I'll talk about Daniel Blake in terms of what was interesting to me about it in a bit, but like Lady Bird, I was like, you know, the end title card suggests, you know, what happens to these people, and I don't buy that.
I didn't buy the relationship.
You know, so it's like, how do you expect us to believe that after what we've seen, there's a happy ending for these people? Because you've not suggested that the system or the people who are fighting it in this film are capable of reaching that outcome.
It was totally inadequate, that title card at the end, because so she has more kids and gets to keep them. What happens to the kids that she didn't get to keep? Why did she get to keep them that time round? I don't understand. And I didn't buy the relationship, even though it's supposed to be a real relationship. You know, obviously those two people stay together if that's what happened and they stay together. But again, it's to do with the position, particularly of the Jorge character, is this sort of absolutely unimpeachable martyr who was going to stay with her no matter what. I mean, No one in their right mind would stick. I mean, I just don't buy it. Even though you're telling me it's based on a true story, and it's really interesting how they sort of separated them out into you know, reflections of how, I mean, it's interesting what you say. I think where another reason where Loach is good, and I think, is that relationship between the physical and the social framework and how that impacts on the characters. So, you know, Maggie is a result of, you know, endemic poverty and a history of domestic abuse and all of that. And then Jorge is a product of political exile, racism, xenophobia, and his sort of isolation from his home country. And I do like that that sense in which he is actually positioning specifically in the social milieu why these people or who these people are in relationship to their social positioning, which is socialist filmmaking, if we're talking about the relationship between social realism. And I do agree as well that the best parts of it are where he is depicting that divide and rule, and also where he's depicting the ways in which people are acting out of the structural bureaucracies in which they're positioned, rather than their own, you know, free will, as it were. You know what I mean? They are an evocation of what society is telling them to be like. Do you know what I mean? So it's like, say, for example, you've got the old woman who testifies in court that this couple are abusing each other, or the man is abusing her, and this kind of thing. So all of that stuff does work in that way. But again, it's just how much he goes for the most extreme versions of the worst outcomes that could possibly happen. Do you know what I mean? And is he making those stand in for a reality? You know what I mean? Is he saying that this is what happens all the time to most people? Or is he, for dramatic effect, saying this is the most worst example I could find of the way that the state sort of, you know, oppresses people's lives, or if it's global capitalism, whatever it might be. I also find it ironic, actually, when you think about it, that he is very much a sort of socialist and a pro Jeremy Corbyn sort of Labour. You know, that's his political background. So he's very much in favour of the state having a bigger role in society, isn't he? So it's really interesting how, yeah, but it's obviously the Tory state he's very much against, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, it was interesting because I watched some of it with Beth, my partner, and she, you know, she said, like, you know, does he not realise that socialism is a state and will be a state? And, you know, if it's in government, it's the state, you know, because it's kind of, yeah, it's almost like it's such a direct attack on the conservative state at that time. And, you know, it's, I think what, you know, Ladybird is clearly drawn from one person's experience, and it's so loyal to that, and is to a version that it just feels so airless. And I don't think it does the real person any justice at all if they manage to kind of get themselves out of that situation and have a relationship with, you know, I just thought that the telling of that story was so, yeah, it just didn't fit. And I think, you know, again, watching that with the other films, Raining Stones and Riff Raff, which are released, you know, in the collection, I was just like, the performances just don't carry it. You know, there's things that I don't like about those other films, but I love watching, you know, Ricky Tomlinson. I think he's brilliant in both those films. You know, Robert Carlyle's great. You know, there's so many great performances in those films that you just, that kind of carry those sometimes, yeah, kind of contentious and kind of didactic moments. And then, you know, then there's Daniel Blake, and which seems like Raining Stones and Riff Raff to work better, because it's not an individual's, but it's kind of a, you know, there's clearly been research into a lot of different experiences, so that it feels more diverse in terms of the types of things and less specific. You know, there's that, you know, and it also feels like there's a mellowing of the people who work within the state, which, like you say, is absolutely spot on, because it's been a Labour controlled state. So he's kinder to the people who you might find now working there, who might have worked in it, you know, when it was a Labour government, and now, you know, there's more people in it and more people in society who are kinder, you know, which I think is kind of telling. What I kind of found myself when I was watching Daniel Blake was thinking, like, this is, I find it really clunky and clumsy, and his performance, which kind of gets better as the film goes on, just doesn't work, you know. And then it makes me think, yeah, there's a lot of times I watch Loach films and I just think they're not very good films, you know. And I think that they kind of live, you know, they live or die by the performances. And sometimes he doesn't cast great. He casts for his, you know, for something that he wants to be authentic, but it doesn't always lead to a good experience. And then some of the stuff that he's trying to do in Daniel Blake, particularly early on, it's just lost because I'm out of the experience because it, I don't buy it. I'm just not, you know, and ultimately it kind of accrues a weight, which is devastating. But, you know, you can see why it wouldn't work unless you were a specific mindset and you viewed the world and you had a political and kind of cultural, like, you know, sense of what you thought the world should be, because it's as an experience, it's massively off-putting because it's in places it's really, really awkward.
Yeah, I mean, jarring. And I guess just sort of, I mean, we've been going a little while now. We'll sort of coming to the end. I suppose the one thing sort of rewatching all of these films is the relationship between cinema and politics, and whether cinema can ever really affect, you know, political change or discussion. And again, you know, this is should it be there to do that, or is this just about kind of like raising awareness? I mean, it's got to be more than that. I mean, you look at his films, they're so, you know, like I, Daniel Blake, and all of the films, they're so clearly, you know, meant to have a very strong and powerful political agenda. And, you know, he's been fighting this fight for years, and it has had, you know, if anything, politics has become more, you know, it's become more and more neoliberalized. I mean, it's one of the interesting things about that Daniel Blake is, again, this sort of, you know, years after Thatcher, you get the kind of kids next door who are buying products from China and selling them, you know, on the black market on the street, the traders and stuff like that. And you say, yeah, no, those guys, I mean, that was interesting to me because it's kind of like, again, this sort of sense of people trying to hustle because they're totally individualized. And then you have there's the bits about the, you know, the 0 hours contract, which is, you know, it's not as didactically put in as, say, something like Riff Raff, where, you know, you get the Ricky Thomason character, who is this sort of very clear agitator, you know what I mean? And what's, you know, what was interesting, I think, back in Riff Raff, I think I enjoy Riff Raff the most out of the films that we saw there. But again, what was interesting about that is that the other working class characters didn't want to speak about it, you know what I mean? So it is that sense of the idea that you're kind of bashing your head against a brick wall. And it seems like sort of Loach's films, you know, at times with the politics, are just trying to hammer against this brick wall that isn't breaking up. And I think that, you know, the fact that these films are perhaps sort of more readily praised or more overtly praised in France, you know, he's a darling of the Cannes Film Festival, whereas I think in the UK they are very much for a very specific type of audience, and not having that sort of position within the UK. I mean, I don't know whether that's sort of changed over time. It would be, you know, I'd have to go and sort of, you'd have to go and sort of research that, whether people's consciousness of Ken Loach. I think he's now in a very sort of singular position where he's really unknown apart from the people who already know who he is. I mean, having said that, there was a lot of discussion about I, Daniel Blake, but again, you know, I don't know. It's a very big question, obviously.
Yeah, I think that, you know, I, Daniel Blake kind of arrived at a moment, you know, and more a case of timing than anything else, you know, in terms of, like you say, Lady Bird deals with so many of the same issues, albeit in kind of a different way, but it's still the same battle, you know, and those battles are in Riff Raff and Raining Stones as well, you know. It's a preoccupation, and has been, and that's great, you know. It's great that there is that, you know, when you sort of say raising awareness, I can see what you mean, but for me it's more, you know, looking back, it's kind of like representing, you know, it's more about, you know, and that's what we're talking about at the moment, like who are the voices on screen, who are the faces on screen, and watching I was thinking, actually, where is that class of people on the cinema screen now, you know? And he is
very overt.
Yeah, he has committed his life to representing that kind of strata of society, and, you know, that's important, you know, and that's why I think he's in, you know, important filmmaker, even if he's not as kind of technically interesting or as adept as someone like Merle, who I think is not interested in that representation in the same way. He's interested in people and the dynamics between people, but less so. I mean, out of those ones, Raining Stones was, you know, I didn't watch all of it again because I realised, oh, actually, I watched this quite recently and wrote a piece in the Directory of World Cinema about films set in Manchester, and I kind of talked at it a little bit length at that time, you know, and that's, you know, that's, I think, I mean, I think I just got a personal affinity for that because of Manchester. You know, I think it's a great film about Manchester and the almost the kind of the mythic kind of Manchester characters, even though obviously Ricky Tomlinson's in it and is from Liverpool, but it's that kind of Northwest myth that it kind of really gets, as well as being quite astute and sad about, you know, kind of families. And that seems more like, you know, Mike Lee, because it's kind of directly about kind of fathers and daughters and those kind of, you know, intergenerational dynamics in a way that other stuff isn't. So, you know, all was worth checking out. Probably don't do what we did, which is watch all of them back to back and then watch Daniel Blake. That's probably a bit too much of an endurance test. But yeah, good to see that, you know, good to see that the films are still being and able to, I think, you know, as well, able to kind of make us think about the relationship between cinema and politics and the politics of the cinema. And I think that's something that we know that we like to do and, you know, are glad to have had the opportunity to do thanks to this kind of moment again, which is the re-release of all this work.
Yeah. And I think that point you made just then about the lack of working class voices is just so spot on. I mean, it's like, I've got it written down here and I'm glad you sort of brought it up because it just, you know, it just makes you realise that we are seeing by default a certain class of film or class represented in film in a certain way, and that's what we get 95% of the time. And just seeing these sort of, you know, just hearing regional accents is kind of unusual, which is kind of crazy, really.
Yeah, and we're watching quite a few things recently, and Beth sort of said, man, these films like hate poor people. You know, an example would be something like Kingsman, which is just an atrocious piece of work, but it really, you know, it really hates poor people, and it's got that real kind of, you know, Thatcherite, you know, bootstraps, you know, pull yourself out of, you know, being poor and being working class into something better. You know, it's really, you know, really cynical and really kind of nasty. And, you know, these films, why they are complicated and have unlikable characters in them a lot of the time, it doesn't really hate the working class or the poor. It tries to represent them, you know, with complexity and diversity, which is still so rare, which is kind of amazing.
Brilliant. Okay, well, that'll be it for our first bonus edition. Thank you, Neil.
Thank you, Dario.
Be ruthless. There was a, with, especially with my conversation, there was a lot of urn and R in there, but that's you know, a common complaint that I have about myself.
Yep, lot to get my teeth into as I embark on my first editing assignment. So
yes,
yeah.
Looking forward to that. So Neil is taking over editing duties for the coming season. So
be gentle, be listeners. Be gentle.
Okay, mate. I'll speak to you later.
Will do. Take care. Mama, they were.